Imagine a day when the doctor of someone who is on the waiting list for a liver or lung transplant creates a tailor-made organ designed especially for the patient's body. It might sound like something out of science fiction, but according to Esquire articles editor Tyler Cabot, this scenario is not only possible, but it's currently being created in Dr. Anthony Atala's lab. In his article, Whatever Happened to Stem Cells, he describes how Dr. Atala, the director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, is currently building a nonprofit public stem cell bank that he hopes will one day supply all ailing Americans with viable organs and also avoid the political setbacks that have in many ways hindered the development of stem cell research. The article appears in the April issue of Esquire. I'm very pleased to welcome Tyler Cabot and Dr. Anthony Atala to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Anthony, let's begin with you. The article envisions a day when people who are fatally ill will be given a blood test and then will be shipped compatible stem cells from a public bank so that their doctors can grow them new organs. The process would just take 4 to 8 weeks. Well, how far off are we from that sort of possibility?
Well, you know, we're actually creating tissues right now that come from the same patient. So the technology now is where we take a very small piece of tissue from the patient, less than half the size of a postage stamp, of the organ of interest, and we then grow the cells outside the body, and we then construct the tissue outside the body and put it back in to the patient, usually within a 4 to 8 week period.
Tyler writes, by their oath, doctors fix and they heal, but they have up to now not created. Do you and other doctors see this as where we're headed?
You know, one of the challenges with the field, of course, is making sure that we can get this to more complex tissues. And so for us, it's really trying to make sure that we can get a lot of these technologies and expand the number of tissues that we can make and also the number of patients that we can reach.
Tyler, you note that it's been 15 years since embryonic stem cells were first harvested and maintained outside the body. Why haven't we seen more progress over all of that time?
Well, you know, I think there are a few reasons. And one, the biggest part is that the science was really hard and is still very hard. Along with that, we put up a lot of political barriers, which made it a very tough atmosphere to do a lot of the science.
Well, that was mostly during the Bush administration. Haven't things changed a bit in the last 4 years?
You know, things have changed a lot. But, you know, one of the things that I was most interested about with Dr. Atala's work was, you know, here is someone who wasn't even really working with embryonic stem cells. You know, his stem cells are from amniotic fluid, and he still hit a lot of barriers. And that was in 07, but we're still feeling some of those repercussions today.
Well, you're in North Carolina, aren't you, Dr. Atala?
Yes, I am.
That's not one of the states that has financed its own programs, but a number of states have, and then there are private groups like the New York Stem Cell Foundation. Have they had much of an impact?
They have, but I think what we're still lacking is an overall sense of national will to really unleash the power of stem cells. And we've had states do this, we've had private companies do this, but this technology really could, you know, revolutionize our health personally and our economy, and it's still very piecemeal.
Is it still just a matter of financing, or have most of the barriers been dropped?
No is the answer on that. I started reporting this article about a year ago, and what was amazing is, you know, when I first started and I went down to see Dr. Atala, you know, there just been some pretty bad news out. Geron had started what was the first embryonic stem cell trial, testing how safe it was, and then it was stopped in the middle because of finances. And then you had the induced pluripotent stem cells, which was a new amazing kind of stem cell that you could actually make from a human adult skin cell and kind of dial it back and make it into a embryonic stem cell. And then, you know, a big paper came out saying, you know what, actually these may have issues and they may be rejected by the body, and also they still are prone to form tumors. And so, you know, at that point, it really, you know, wasn't looking great. And then in the past year, there have been some great advances. But I think one thing over the last 15 years we've seen is that there's always this great kind of hope, and then we hit barriers. And that's the way science works.
Well, Dr. Atala, this public stem cell bank is something you're currently developing. You've called it your life's work. What does it look like? What's there?
We basically, there are many choices for patients, you know, in terms of what could be best use for them, and it really will depend on how they present. So that's the first thing, is it really depends on how the patient presents, what kind of technology we can use for them, and what cell would be best for them. And one of the choices is to use this particular cell that is found in what's called the amniotic fluid, which is the fluid that basically surrounds the developing baby in the womb. And we can also obtain the same cell from the placenta, which is also the afterbirth.
Now, both of those things are, well, placentas sometimes are used for other reasons, but they're pretty much thrown away, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah, both are actually thrown away. You know, the fluid is when the water breaks, basically, that's the fluid that comes out.
Mm-hmm. So you would capture it?
Yeah, you can capture it, or you can, you know, if someone's having surgery for the delivery of the baby, you can capture it then. Or you can just wait till a placenta comes out, which is the afterbirth, which is currently discarded for the most part. And you can use those tissues that are discarded to isolate this particular cell type.
Now, in the past, one of the objections to stem cell research involved abortion concerns and also the cells that had been stored away for some future use. But that doesn't apply here. Are there still people objecting to amniotic fluid and placenta?
Well, the nice thing about these cells is that they're currently just being discarded, you know, so you can just get them from the discard sources. And, of course, you get them after the baby's born. So it's really not a major issue. Now, you can also get the amniotic fluid while the baby's still in the womb in case the baby needs some sort of diagnosis, the developing baby needs some sort of diagnosis. There is a procedure where doctors can go in and take the fluid out to diagnose a condition. And what we would do is basically take some of that discard fluid as well and try to isolate cells from there. But really, you just can wait till the baby's born, and then there are no issues about getting these cells.
My guests are Dr. Anthony Atala, director of Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and Tyler Cabot, articles editor at Esquire, author of an article called Whatever Happened to Stem Cells. It's in the April issue of Esquire. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Atala, will everyone have access to these cells? And how much will it cost?
Well, these cells, basically, you get them from the same baby. That's the first thing, is that you would actually get them from the same child. And you can also obtain these from the mom at the time of birth. So you can actually obtain two cell types from the baby and the mom. And those you can store, and you can use them for future self-use. So that's one way of using these cells. Another way of using these cells is to establish a bank which is large enough that you have enough genetic variability within your cell bank. That means you have enough cells that you can use in many people to avoid rejection. And so both things are being looked at right now with this bank. And of course, the financial model of the bank is one that we're looking at very closely to make sure that these banks can be self-sustained over the long run.
Will there be any ethical questions as to who should be healed, as we've seen with organ transplants?
One of the nice things about having these technologies is you're really trying to expand the resource, and that's really what this is all about. We are really having so many challenges right now with organ transplantation. There's so many advances that have been made over time in the field.
Well, though we just really had some people come down with rabies as a result of an organ transplant.
Yeah, there's still challenges. You know, so many advances and so many lives that have been saved, but still challenges that are still around, like disease that you can get with the organ, like rejection, where the organ gets rejected and is no longer useful, or what you just mentioned, not just having enough of them around. That's a real problem because the number of patients on the transplant list keeps increasing substantially. Well, at the same time, the number of actual transplants has remained fairly flat.
But you mentioned rejection of stem cells. When does that happen?
Well, basically, in the rejection area, you're looking at problems any time that you put in an organ that is not from the same patient. And the way to avoid that problem, of course, is to use a patient's own cells to create that organ. And you can do that with some of the cells that we save, because if we save that baby's cells at the time of birth, then you have a natural repository of cells that can go back into that same patient for the rest of their lives, where there would be no rejection.
So you mean every child born would wind up with a little bank account, in effect, to be there if there's a future problem?
That is the hope. Eventually the hope is that these could be safe for every baby that's so.
We're talking about millions and millions of these cells being saved.
Yeah, there are about 4 to 4.5 million births per year in the U.S. every year. And right now, these specimens are just being discarded. So it would just be a matter of saving these specimens for each baby born. Again, we talked about having a bank that is large enough, and about 100,000 specimens, unique specimens, could supply about 90% of the U.S. population with a genetic match for transplantation. So you can go and use the bank in either direction.
Now, Tyler, one scientist told you that the red tape involved in stem cell research is leading to researchers leaving the United States to pursue their work. One of the top American spinal research labs at Rutgers even does all of its research and clinical trials in China. How have the political debates affected the culture of the people in this field?
I think in a few ways. If you look at the Geron trial, they'd put about $145 million into the research of that. As I was talking to Ed Wirth, who helped run that trial, he said, there's a difference between being on the bleeding edge and on the cutting edge. And being on the bleeding edge means that you're responsible for doing the foundational research, which is incredibly expensive. And it became too expensive for them. And it's almost like asking, a private space company to send a space, up to the moon without giving them the institutional know-how from NASA over decades.
Wasn't it even rougher during the Bush years because scientists were told they had to maintain totally separate laboratories if they were working within a research facility?
For sure.
Otherwise,
all
funding would be lost for both the work that they were doing and the work the other people were
for
doing.
For sure. And that's how, I visited the New York Stem Cell Foundation near Harlem. And that was a foundation that grew, straight from this, from people not being able to do their work at Columbia.
Dr. Atala, have you ever been tempted to move your lab to Canada or some other friendly country?
Well, one of the challenges we have, of course, is to be sure that we can advance the science and to make sure that we can advance it at the right pace. And having, having the technologies that we use today, we are basically using these cell types that come from the same patient. And this other cell type, which actually comes from the patient's own tissue or to bank it. So we haven't had those challenges at this point, but it's certainly a real challenge in science today. And, of course, we've had concerns about that for some time.
Now, scientists have had to rely on private funding, sometimes corporate, which means their work is often patented and privately owned. Does that complicate your vision for a public stem cell bank?
Well, one of the things that made this possible is that, we actually were the group that found these cells a few years back, so that our group felt strongly that this would be really a nice resource to make it available to everyone and not to really make it into a private enterprise.
Do you have to be careful about who you accept money from?
Well, you always have to be careful to make sure there are no special interests. But in this case, I think the concept of the public bank is really one that allows everyone to benefit. And so there's no industry behind it. There are no special interests behind it. It's just really an effort to make cells available for patients, both for research purposes as well as for patients in the future, hopefully.
Do you have to devote a lot of time to fundraising?
Well, we just started the launch of the bank. And, when Tyler actually started to write this piece for Esquire magazine, we talked a lot about you know, the possibility of this bank and what it would mean. And so we actually started to shape this this bank concept a couple of years ago, and we do plan to launch. We of course are launching it this year, so we are now starting to collect specimens for research and getting the facility ready to actually start collecting specimens for future clinical use once the time is right.
My guests are Dr. Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and Tyler Cabot, who's an articles editor at Esquire, author of Whatever Happened to Stem Cells? It's in the April issue of Esquire. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Tyler Cabot, articles editor at Esquire, author of Whatever Happened to Stem Cells? It's in the April issue of Esquire. And also with us is the subject of, or a subject of his article, Dr. Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Tyler, a colleague described Dr. Atala to you as a modern-day Frankenstein, but didn't he mean it as a compliment?
For sure. I mean, you know, one of the most unique and amazing things about Dr. Atala is that he's actually creating. And I think a lot of doctors fix and they heal. And Dr. Atala, you know, is actually building things. He's building organs, and he has a new vision for the way in which we can heal ourselves, which is, you know, if my kidney breaks or my liver or something else, is that we can actually build an organ outside the body and then implant it.
And some of your most significant discoveries, Dr. Atala, seem to have happened by accident. Wasn't your creation of the world's first tissue-engineered organ the result of someone giving you a laser to play with?
Yes, that's right. So actually, we were in the operating room, and they were discarding one of these laser machines that were being used in surgery. And so I figured I would take it into the laboratory. And really just exploring with a laser gave us very interesting insights about cell growth and expansion and where these cells may be that could actually be isolated and grown outside the body in large quantities. And that really allowed us to advance our work by creating these engineered organs.
You know, this is Tyler. One of the more interesting things about Dr. Atala is he says these things, and he kind of takes the amazing backstories out of them, which was that he was taking this laser up, and he was just doing experiments on his own with mouse bladders. And I was amazed by that.
This is mouse bladders.
Yeah, just to kind of see how they would scar and actually if they would. And he, you know, as he described to me, he stayed up all night blasting this laser with these mouse bladders and, you know, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, what have you, and came back the next morning. You know, expecting to see these scars, and instead they'd healed. And, you know, this was, no one would have ever believed this. And this became, you know, the foundation of his first paper, which was rejected because nobody could actually believe that bladder cells could grow outside the body.
Well, don't they try to duplicate it?
Well, Dr. Atala, his work, he was trying to duplicate an initial paper, which didn't work. And then he said to the guy, look, this won't work. And he said, Dr. Atala, it's impossible to do this. So he actually tried a different way. And then, you know, I think they must have eventually decided, and I think perhaps, you know, Dr. Atala can tell us.
Well, did you also reach another breakthrough in kidney regeneration after you picked up a rock on a beach?
That's an interesting story. But basically, I was just walking down the beach and picked up this rock that was shaped like a kidney. And, you know, I had been working on trying to engineer kidney tissue, but I just couldn't get past the challenge of how to create these tissue and actually make it useful in a patient. And our limitations at the time were that we could just create pieces of tissue. And so it was interesting because I looked at the rock and it has this seam on the side of the rock, and the seam is something that's actually present in nature, in everybody's kidney. You have this area on the side of the kidney that has the least vascularity or the least blood vessel supply. And that's actually an area where, as surgeons, we open up the kidney along that line because it bleeds the least. And it basically gave to a series of thoughts that would be the way to get around it, to actually create kidney tissue and then we would be able to put it in this avascular plane or plane where it wouldn't bleed, and yet augment the functionality of the organ, trying to get us to where we need it to be to really help help patients avoid the problems of kidney failure.
Well, how do you direct blank stem cells to become one kind of tissue or another, to become a kidney, for example?
Well, our number one priority is to try to use the patient's own cells, and so those cells already know what they are.
But they're kidney cells on a diseased kidney, aren't they?
Yes, and so even in a deceased organ, you still have a population of these immature cells. They have not matured yet into what they need to become, so they have not yet been injured. And so we actually try to get the cell population that is still in its infancy stage, that these cells have not really become the full kidney cell, and so they have not yet been impacted. So every organ has a stem cell population within it, where the cells are not yet developed, and you can harvest those cells and then drive them to become what they're supposed to become. And then we have the alternate approach that if you don't have enough cells, you know, let's say you don't have the organ, let's say that you were in a motor vehicle accident and you lost the organ you had and you don't have cells, then we can actually use a stem cell population.
And you're using pig kidneys as a base in some cases?
Well, we're using different strategies. You know, Tyler mentioned, you know, was referring to one of the strategies, which is, you know, related to what we did, you know, when we found that rock, for example. But we're working on several strategies to engineer tissue for solid organs. And one of them involves taking donor organs and using very mild detergents to wash the cells away. And then you're left with this three-dimensional mold, and then you're able to reseed that mold with the patient's own cells.
You know, one of the most interesting things to me about Dr. Tall's work is you know, he really is a builder. And with these cells, with these organs, you really have to figure out how to build them. And you can't just, you know, take 22 different, you know, kind of cells to build a kidney and put it in a petri dish, because the cells aren't going to know what to do.
You say that it has to be done in a specific order.
It's got to be done in a specific order and in a specific way. And a lot of it really is like building a house. And if you don't have the boiler in the right place, it's not going to work with, you know, with the electricity or with the heat or with the plumbing. And so, you know, a lot of the big challenges now with building organs is how do you actually build the right scaffold? And, you know, in Dr. Tah's lab, they you know, do this where they can, you know, wash the cells out of a scaffold that is already there with a pig kidney, or you can try building a scaffold from scratch. You know, and another very interesting aspect of this is even if you have the cells in the right place, they all need to communicate properly. And as someone, you know, explained it to me, you know, it's like if someone builds me an office and I get there and there's just, you know, equipment to make sandwiches or ice cream, I'm not going to know how to write. I'm going to be making ice cream. So you really have to have it in an environment where these cells know how to properly act.
My guest is Tyler Cabot. His article, Whatever Happened to Stem Cells, is in the April issue of Esquire. And Dr. Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Is there any risk to using stem cells? The article explains that even though stem cells can grow up to be anything, they have deep-seated proclivities and things can go wrong when they're pushed too far in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, there are huge risks, and that's a lot of what what scientists are trying to overcome.
And so, Dr. Atala, how do you prevent them from growing out of control and becoming cancerous?
Well, I think there are several ways to do that. The first most direct way is to take cells from the same organ, where these cells already know what they're supposed to do. And if you can't, then you can use other sources of stem cells. And the stem cell we've been looking at closely, now we've been looking at many stem cell types, but the one we've been looking at the most has been these cells that we already mentioned a little bit earlier that surround the developing baby in the womb, what's called amniotic fluid stem cells, or stem cells from the placenta, which is coming from the afterbirth. And these cells are slightly more mature than embryonic stem cells, or what is currently called induced pluripotent stem cells. These are very early stage cells. these cells are further down the line of development. I think Tyler made a nice analogy in his article where he called them, these are more like kindergartner cells.
Yeah, I mean...
Because they help you overcome the objections to using embryonic stem cells?
No, because, you know, I think you can... You know, one thing that I think was also lost in this big stem cell debate was that there are multiple kinds of stem cells. And so if you can think of embryonic stem cells almost as infants, they have full potential like a newborn would to be a doctor or a lawyer or anything. The same way a embryonic stem cell can become liver or heart or a neuron. If you go a little bit further down the line, you get amniotic, which, you know, they're a little bit older and they're starting to kind of get their traits. So maybe they're really into, you know, trucks or math at that point. You're saying, oh, you're kind of going in that direction. Or the, you know, you can kind of sense that they're leaning towards being heart tissue. And that gives them stability so that they're less likely to kind of go the wrong direction.
And then adult stem cells are much more limited because they are
adults
specific.
They are like the retired professionals. You know, we know they've been, you know, engineers for 70 years. And then we're saying, no, you know what? You got to come out of retirement and you got to start over again. And they do. But they're a lot harder to coax, and they grow a lot more slowly.
Dr. Atala, Sean from Bergen County has asked on our show page about whether some of these problems can be solved via the injection of functional cells rather than creating new organs.
Yes, absolutely. So that's another of the strategies. So, in fact, we really are looking at five different strategies for the treatment of solid organs. The first one that we mentioned was to just create a wafer that you can insert in the organ. The second is to actually take an organ, a donor organ, wash the cells away and replace them with the patient's own cells. A third way is to actually just inject cells in the area of injury, and that works well for focused areas or defects where you need to boost the functionality of the organ a certain percentage. And yet another strategy we have followed is to actually print the organs, where we use power printing to print these three-dimensional organs. And finally, the last strategy that we are looking at is to harness the power of the organ itself to self-regenerate by using proteins or small molecules or other vehicles to make that happen.
Now, if a person has liver cancer or a pancreatic cancer, can you still use those cells? Wouldn't they be prone to becoming cancerous?
Yeah, so the major directive there is to make sure that you take the stem cells that have not yet gone that path. And so every organ, when there's cancer, of course, you have normal cells and abnormal cells, and the key there is to make sure that you take the normal cells and that you're able to confirm, of course, that they're normal before you create the new tissue.
Now, Tyler, you write that Dr. Atala's research has been used as political ammunition by both the right and the left. How have political debates affected the potential developments in this area?
I mean, what I was talking about specifically was the amniotic work. And, you know, it took Dr. Atala about 10 years to get these cells and to show that they actually worked. And it happened that when his paper was finally published, it was, you know, days before the Democrats were seeking to overturn President Bush's restrictions.
It was 2007.
Yes, correct. And so finally, you know, Republicans said, oh, wow, and they gave these press conferences. Well, you know, as you can see from Dr. Atala's work, you know, we actually don't need embryonic stem cells. And so, you know, the other side was Dr. Atala was urged to write a letter saying that we still do, and you know, because it was his belief we did. And that letter was then used by Democrats to say, look, Dr. Atala says, hey, you know, we don't actually, you know, we actually still need embryonic stem cells. And, you know, a few months later, a bill started, you know, going through both, you know, the Senate and then the House that would, you know, really set the foundation for the amniotic bank that Dr. Atala is setting up right now. And it did pass the Senate. But in the House, the Democratic leadership wouldn't let it actually come up for a vote. And
why was that? That was before the Republicans took over the House.
Well,
if the Democrats liked it in the Senate, why didn't the Democrats like it in the House?
Because, you know, a lot of what happened with the stem cell debate was that it became a zero-sum game. And, you know, the thought was if we support an amniotic stem cell bank, we're going to be saying we don't need embryonic. And, you know, at the time, that was the main priority of Democrats.
Dr. Atala, what are the induced pluripotent stem cells? Why might they be the future of this research?
Yeah, so it's a nice cell type. You actually can take cells from pretty much anywhere in the body, and that's potentially you can take from anywhere in the body, although you can get them from skin right now. You can get them even from many tissue types in the body, and you can take that one cell and drive it back all the way to have the properties which are similar to a human embryonic stem cell. And so these cells can have the potential to turn into many different cells as well.
That's how you've called it, the Benjamin Buttoning cells.
Yeah, I mean, they're an amazing technology. But we're still not there yet. And one of the also very interesting things about, you know, my last year of reporting was, you know, numerous people said to me, look, there are no perfect stem cells. It's not like we're going to get iPS set and we're going to be done with amniotic or embryonic or vice versa. And they all have better uses for certain things. And we're pushing the science on all of them to see what will actually work the best for different indications.
Dr. Atala, another researcher once told me that he was told by someone in Congress, if there had just been some major breakthrough, a lot of the political problems would not be occurring. But we haven't had any real major breakthrough, have we?
Well, with the stem cell field, it's been a challenge because of the patient safety concerns when it comes to human embryonic stem cells and induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, because as Tyler mentioned, these cells do have the potential to form tumors.
You have 15 seconds.
Yeah, may also have the potential to reject. So basically, it's one of those things where the field is evolving, and we really need to make sure that these cells are safe, but at the same time, make sure that they're useful.
And my great thanks to my guest, Dr. Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and Tyler Cabot. His article, Whatever Happened to Stem Cells, is in the April issue of Esquire magazine. Thank you both.